And welcome. A little belatedly, a little excitement around the studio here, but we took care of it. Tom took care of it, and we're under control. This is still KROV Oroville. And my Our Town guest, special guest today, is Mr. John Rivers. John, I know it's not news to you, but it could be news to somebody. And that is a little bit about your background, because that lets folks know a little bit about why you're here and what you're thinking.
Well, background covers a lot, Lee.
I know that.
If we want to start with my chronology, I was born in Louisiana, and my mother migrated along with a large number of other black people from northwest Louisiana and from northeast Arkansas to Oroville in the 1940s. My earlier relatives arrived around 1943, and my mother came in 1945, and she brought my brothers and sister out, left me in Louisiana, and then she came back in 1949. So I moved to Oroville in 1949, attended school locally, and graduated from high school, went on to Chico State, got drafted because I dropped out, spent 2 years in the United States Army, came out of there, understood the importance of actually graduating from college rather than attending college, gave me greater opportunities. So I went back and got my bachelor's degree at Chico State, then took a job, a summer job that lasted into 43 years of work in higher education.
Wow. Okay, that's a story in itself. And since a lot of what we're going to be talking about today is historical and about black history in particular and about Southside Oroville and all those things, I guess sort of one thing you said was just a sentence, like, my mom moved out here. Now, I don't suppose we have enough hours to say why the deuce she did it, but you get what I'm saying?
Yes.
Just in general, and then why leave there, and why in the devil Oroville? It's sort of like you got...
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing to me.
That's an important question. And the reason why it's important is, quite simply, when people leave a familiar environment and they go to an environment for which they have no clue, that takes a lot of courage. So there had to be something that was pulling my mother and others to come to Oroville in particular. Well, in the larger scheme of things, there have been three major migration in the history of the United States. Migration from the east and southeast, west. And all of these migrations were prompted by economic incentives, work, and opportunity for growth and progress for individuals as well as their families. So African Americans, like other groups, were leaving something that was not satisfactory for them in terms of their full expression of being a human being. And for black people in the South, it was leaving Jim Crow. Jim Crow was another kind of American brand caste system where the color of your skin would regulate the amount of opportunity and benefit you would have. And for black people, after the Civil War and during the Reconstruction, the social barriers that was placed on them was to deny them access to progress and opportunity, but to relegate them to the types of support roles in terms of work, in terms of education, and certainly to keep them at a safe distance away from the privileged class, white people. That's not a very good life plan for an American. Americans are saturated with the belief that if you work hard and you are complicit with the rules, the civil rules of society, if you participate and you conduct yourself as a member of the group rather than an antagonist of the group, then you should share in the benefits of citizenship, full citizenship. Well, that was not the case. And so my mother, like other black people, sought better opportunities. And there was opportunity in Oroville in terms of work. And that's what brought my mother here.
Yeah, because I was wondering about the West Coast and where you would hear about it, way the devil over in Arkansas. It seems like Underground Railroad of thought. People tell people.
That's right.
Somebody knows. Somebody happened to just be wandering around. They found out, and they write back home. Hey, you know,
exactly.
In Oroville, there's jobs. Something like that happens.
Exactly. You see, there was this movement away from the South on the part of African Americans. It's been validated that there were 6 million black people who left the South. At the beginning, at the latter parts of the 1800s through the 1970s, that this was a steady, progressive, ever-increasing large number of black people. And the sequence would be one member of the family, or one member of the extended family would wind up in another location, establish themselves, and then send back for the rest.
Yeah, yeah. This is something you... All right, I'm just going to ask questions without... I'm going to try to.
Okay.
Makes me wonder, when I think of a class like people with white skin keeping down a group... They're easily identifiable. You don't have to know their personalities. You look in their face and say, oh, this is somebody of that tribe. To what real advantage? What? This is something around the world, I guess. But
mm-hmm.
You must have thought about what motivates that prejudice. What motivates? Is it fear that they're going to displace you? They're going to get more money and then you'll have less? Or... either tyrannist or what in the devil do you think?
Well, there's a lot of explanations, academic, intellectual, political, religious basis for explaining that. But one of the things that seemed to me, I'm much more of a naturalist, and I look at things as they are rather than how I would like to them to be. What seemed to be a familiar pattern throughout the history that I've read, is that when individuals become threatened, and usually those threats are surround resources, scarce resources, they create a reason to resist, control, and deny people who they perceive as different. From benefiting, from participating. And I think you can look at every event in history where there have been civilizations that have been developed and passed away. That usually the sequences that occur before they pass away is conflict. And so out of that conflict comes people who have more privilege and more benefits. And it continues to repeat itself. Even in modern times, we have very different ways of expressing that, what I call primitive way of thinking and behaving. But the pattern seems to be consistent. Now, with regards to whites keeping blacks in control and down, they had a very easy way to do that, and they still have a very easy way to do it. Just identify the color of a person's skin, the nature of the hair texture, their physical skeletal features, and then voila, you have that person already tagged, you have them stigmatized, and you know that that's the other. That's not sure. You. And so whatever your motivations are, you know, they act themselves out with that kind of perception.
Sure. Readily identified, like all those signs. I'm really largely from the North, but I was shocked in about 1960, something like that. No, 69. Little country town in North Carolina, and I went to a restaurant, and they said, no, you go around the other door. Mm-hmm. I made the mistake of going around into the wrong door, and then, of course, then you see the sign. And how clever.
Yeah.
For colored patrons only. Mm-hmm. It's not saying black people stay out here. It's saying, this colored. Is for you. Mm-hmm. This is our gift to you. This in this lunch counter, or you can go in this door. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'd heard about it. I wasn't totally unaware of it, but again, growing up mostly in New Jersey, what an experience. And that was, well, okay, I guess I'm getting old fast, but 1970 seemed pretty modern to me.
Yeah.
And to think, well, anyway, I guess we all know it, but actually probably a lot of people don't. People who haven't really been in those areas where there has strict segregation, and when they haven't been there and they haven't seen it, they hear about it, but what's the impact? It probably doesn't make as much impact.
Well, I think the reason why we're having this conversation is because we are still dealing with a very effectively constructed view of differences and privilege and benefit. And, you know, the high point of it started at the development of this country as the Native Americans' land.
Right.
Their beliefs.
Of course.
Their religion was subjugated. And it started there. And then but see, when people who consider themselves Christians do that to another group of people, they have to develop some kind of a rationale that keeps them consistent with being a Christian and separates them from the responsibility of the injury they're inflicting on other people.
Yeah.
And the way in which, in my view, the way in which that happens is that not only do the businessman and the minister or the priest or the rabbi or the guru, all of the people who represent various parts of the community have to be in agreement. And then all of the media that is present during that historical period has to reflect that. And the educational system has to reflect that. So it really is a very powerful.
Oh, boy. I think John Rivers has just won the lottery. This is the phone call telling him where to cash his check. So we got to. This is very important. Plus, it gives me a chance to say, This is Lee Edwards in conversation with John Rivers, and this is KROV Oroville 91.1 FM. Got to keep reminding people of who we are.
I'm sorry.
Well, that came at a. It's sort of you were sort of winding down a point there, I guess,
yeah.
And I see it. And then of course I will only take 10 seconds or less more. I see it on national levels too. One nation covets something somewhere else, and then they create things, and
yeah.
then they like dehumanizing Islam and dehumanizing
yeah.
their terrorists and all and so on.
Yeah, that's a very yeah. familiar pattern.
Yeah, human behavior.
Yeah, yeah. It's not human potential, though. It's human behavior. It's where we are now,
yeah.
and it's how we act now. But we can act a lot better.
Boy, I'd like to feel some real sunny optimism on that. Because to me, at the very base of anything, even though it gets into these other areas, is in quotes survival. But I can imagine a caveman wanting to survive and, you know, wanting to kill a neighbor because there were, you know, weren't that many animals to kill in his area or something. But I can now, with things that are available, with the conveniences, the comforts, the environment is just something around us, or maybe we love it, but it doesn't threaten us with life or death or freezing very much. Everything's comfortable, so maybe you're right. Maybe it's time we realized that and said, hey, you know, what the devil are we doing this for?
Well, if you take the caveman's experience, if you can project yourself into that era, their main survival, their main focus was survival.
Yeah.
And since they didn't have the modern conveniences that we have, and they had much bigger challenges from the environment and from the animals that existed during those times, they had to develop a bigger brain.
Yeah.
In order to be able to minimize the power and the challenge of the environment and its inhabitants, but they had to maximize their potential to survive, and that took all day.
Yeah,
all week.
I don't even want to think about that. Oh my, I am so spoiled. What's the temperature? Oh my gosh, it's down to 68. You know, we better turn up the thermostat or put another piece of wood on the stove.
Yeah,
boy, are we ever spoiled, huh?
Yeah.
We got it made, and we don't know it.
But that's interesting how the human mind works, though. I'm convinced that for many of the current generations, they really have a state of consciousness that said life started and the world started when I was born.
Oh, yes.
Nothing preceded that. And there is no continuum. But there is a continuum. There was something that happened before
sure.
we were all born. And the real question is, are we going to be able to fully benefit for the sacrifices that our ancestors have made? And one of the things that works against that is the fact that we continue to find clever ways to influence, control, and manipulate those who have less power and influence in our society. We find a rationale
yeah.
to do that.
Oh, it doesn't come out as we're going to get those guys. It's going to be, well, we're going to do it our way, and
right.
and they're just going to be minimized.
Yeah,
unless they get to be one of, in quotes, us, whatever that is. And
yeah, if we, it's like the grand plan that was at work in America during the height of the immigration of the Europeans coming to America. The idea was that we had different people coming from different areas of Europe who talked, whose language was different. Well, in order for them to be a contributor to what was going on in America, they have to become Americans. And they had to change their language. They have to modify certain traditions. And the idea was that they would become us. They would come in because we were the standard.
Sure.
We were the model. And for those groups that came out of European countries, they can point back to their history and they can show progress. They can really show it. And but if we want to go to the starting point, even the ones who came over from Europe experienced hardship. There's no question about it. But if you compare their lot with the Native American or the African American,
right,
they started at a much higher
sure.
stage
sure.
of opportunity. And that cannot be swept under the rug. You can't go forward unless you understand what happened.
Yeah. But by the same thought process, you come to the idea, at least I do, that after a few generations, this didn't necessarily die, but it became less important. It was much easier for somebody to come from another country. And so actually, don't you think that was in a way a progress? Because the immigrant picture, so-called, changed?
Well, the immigrant had from Europe had one advantage, and it still is an advantage. They were white.
Yeah, there you go.
They were white. And,
okay,
and
sure.
So that color-coding practice worked for them, not against
gotcha.
Them.
Gotcha. So you wouldn't exclude them on that, and you might say, well, they talk funny. So
they talk funny.
So they learn how to talk the language, and the next thing you know, there they are.
That's right.
And
they're not one of them.
No, they're not one of them. Yeah. Boy. John Rivers here today, by the way. This is KROV Oroville. This is Our Town. And we appreciate you tuning in. Barring technical difficulties, this interview will be available on our website one of these days, and a recording will be available. You can call Lee Edwards at the station, and I can work that out for you, maybe. Just don't call too soon. My wife is recording it at home, so at least we'll have a recording from there. Okay, so John kindly brought some questions. I have questions from our prior interview and thoughts. And here's a quote. We're going to do this first before we go into anything. This is a quote, not verbatim, from John Rivers from a while back. You can figure what came before it, and he says, evolution of a people who have come out of bondage and established themselves as an integral part of this country and still have a long way to go towards equity. Could you, not now, but is this something this is firmly implanted in John Rivers' mind, I'll bet.
And supported by facts.
Yes, yes. So in our little sheet of things to talk about, which we don't have to follow, because John certainly has a fascinating mind. And I guess I got to start with my cynicism. This is Black History Month. Oh boy!
Right.
1 month a year, we get to recognize something. And say, oh, look at this, and this one's a football player, and that one's a singer, and isn't it wonderful, and they can drink out of any water fountain.
Right.
And then we go back on doing things like we always have. So anyway, how has a teaching of Black history impacted the quality of relationship between various races that make up the U.S. population? So I was cynical. I picked a negative thing, which I apologize for, really. Whether it's true or not, you decide.
You know, actually, the cynic is very important to this discussion because it's the cynic that challenges fantasy. And I think that a cynical or at least a critical analysis really helps us all understand the gravity of the problem that we're trying to deal with. My point is simply this, And that's why I'm the ultimate optimist. My point is simply this, and that is, if we understand that human beings are heavily influenced by the historical period of their times, what was going on then? What was reality then? And we'll factor that in. Then we would have a way to begin to measure progress or lack of. And I think it's very interesting that if you look at the election of the and the re-election of the current president of the United States, I read and heard and observed people saying, "Well, you know, the race problem is over." Well, that was so silly. Because if you take the full meaning of race, it included white people.
All right.
See, and they're a race.
You wise guy. You're a tricker. You use these big words and wonderful thoughts, and then you sneak in a zinger like that. But how does that ever make a white person blush, huh? If they would listen to that and take it in their heart, they would turn right, bright red.
So,
yes,
to say that you don't see race is
yes
absurd. You see race. It's the meaning that you put into that is where all the problems are. And I think that I'll give you a perfect example. I've been thinking about this a lot, Lee. I watched a documentary on Nelson Mandela. And, I've had enough higher education experience and training and all that to be able to identify in a documentary the showbiz aspect of it. And I can call out the real social issues that were happening. Apartheid was an interesting form of government, saying that the races are not equal, but that and that the races should be separated, and that essentially black people were inferior. They weren't able to participate as full citizens of their country, since the Europeans that came over that took control didn't originate there.
Yeah.
But the way in which they resolved that, and the world, I have to say the world chimed in on this. It was so vividly clear what was going on that the world could not stand by and say, and turn their head and say, well, that's not a problem. That's not a issue of humanity. That the world forced the government to be complicit with the realities that there should be one man, one vote, okay? And that if you want to be elected as a politician, you must appeal to everybody to get the most votes, which is fair, fair game. I've been thinking about that because I remembered what happened after that had been this transition. Desmond Tutu was commissioned by Nelson Mandela to convene what he called a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And what happened was people who had done atrocities towards Africans were offered amnesty if they came forth and told the truth about what really happened and how they experienced what they did and how they feel now. What happened is people began to give some validation to the atrocities that took place that they participated in. And once a person begins to deal with the truth of the matter, then they can do something else. But if they're still trying to hold on to that experience, and say it didn't happen or it wasn't that way or there was a reason why it happened, we'll never get beyond that. I think we will. I think we will. The election of Barack Obama was not the signal that we had overcome or we had won. That was and is an opportunity for us to begin serious discussion about why it is we're discussing this.
Yeah. Yeah. Why should we be, why should anybody be excited about this? Why should they be? Isn't it silly that they would have to be excited? Isn't it silly that it should be an issue?
Yeah. Well, it's silly, but it is an issue.
Sure.
And
is.
We need to understand the nature of the issue. But you know what really is interesting about the history of our republic, as I've read, there are times when all of the silliness breaks down, and it becomes back to the attention of everybody. It is about survival, and the question is my chances better being cooperative, or is it better still holding on to these tried and true control mechanisms? And throughout our history, we have dropped that prejudicial behavior in times when we had mutual threat, and we have come together. And then, as soon as that initial threat of survival recedes, we go right back.
Yeah. Could you do? I'm thinking of one, but could you do just one or two quick examples of that? Just very simple examples.
All right. When I was working on my master's in sociology at Chico State, I took a class entitled "The Sociology of the Military," and this was a graduate student, so I was allowed to do a major research paper on race relations in the military. And I began to be fascinated, because this was a time that the Vietnam War was going on. And I began to become very fascinated by the news magazine stories of the war. And one of the things that piqued my attention was that they had talked about how much evidence of integration they saw, particularly as the servicemen went out in the field and they were in combat. And, you know, that blacks would share their blood with whites and whites would share their blood. And they were a band of brothers. As soon as they got back to Saigon for what they call R&R, rest and recuperation, the black servicemen went to their bars. The white servicemen went to their bars. It even got down to the point that Vietnamese women would follow the practices of the United States servicemen. In other words, if you were a Vietnamese woman and you were in a relationship with a white soldier, you would not talk to blacks. You would treat them the same way as a white person would treat them. The same is true with the Vietnamese woman that went, with black soldiers. Now, this was being reported by newsmen, and they were men, they weren't women, during that time who was there. They saw that. And it occurred to me, how can it be true here that people don't behave as if there's some stigma to purely working together, cooperating? And when you get back, when the heat is off, you go right back to those primitive behaviors. Well, I think it's because this idea of survival is common to all of us. But what is not common to all of us or agreed to by all of us is a sharing of social benefit. That is not, we don't agree on that.
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of have to be forced into being a type of person that you really should be.
Hmm.
hard times, threats, those things will force someone into being what they should have been all along, joining together and working. Yeah, well, Black History again. I did that cynical thing, which I shouldn't have. But as you said, it wasn't cynical. It was critical.
It's critical.
So, anyway, the teaching of Black History, it certainly has, and that's been going on for a long time. It certainly has brought awareness. The fact that they talk about Black History, I mean, this certainly, don't you feel, has made some positive. What would you say, contributions, positive impacts?
Well, I can tell you it has, and I can use myself as a perfect example. I was the first Black teacher hired by Butte College when it started. And I was only hired because I was Black, and they wanted me to develop a Black history course. Now, my major and my degree at that time was in sociology. So I had to scramble because there weren't that many books written on Black history. And what happened to me was I began to discover that the real need for Black history was because there hadn't been much research on it. And if it had taken place, it was not a part of the curriculum, which said to me that students are getting a part of history that is absent. Other groups experience within that historical period. So that's the first value I see. Now we have ample amount of research that begins to fulfill United States history with the inclusion of history from various groups. I have a question and I have a problem with how we talk about history. That is to say, and you pointed out earlier as when you were playing the cynic, that, you know, Black History Month, here we are, now we can talk about the star athlete or the successful businessman or what have you. Well, see, looking at history that way also provides an incomplete understanding of the historical involvement of all groups in making things happen. You know, so I think that the history that I think that takes into account Black people's involvement, experience, contributions, and aspirations is helpful in bringing this big person's history into perspective. In other words, you know, we might say George Washington was a great leader, but he needed to have somebody to lead, and they had to do certain things so he could do that. So it's all connected. And so when we start looking at history more through heritage rather than who was the first to do this and who was the first to do that, then we get a much more holistic understanding of human history how groups fit into the events of the times. And so to that extent, I do believe that Black history has been beneficial to understanding the events, the comprehensive events of the times. Like, I do research with the organization that I'm president of, which is the South Oroville African American Historical Society. And some people say, well, you just work on Black history of Black people. And I say, well, how can you do that if you don't include white people?
Where are you going to find that information? That is hilarious.
Yeah, but the fact is that there would be no white history unless there was other history.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Well, like people own history if they got a certain heritage or lineage or whatever. Okay. So I think basically what you're saying is that Black history, I probably can't say it the way you did, is a value in that properly studied, it includes all events and all races and all people. It's a study of history, and yes, maybe you're picking out events particular to Black people, but they are not isolated no more than anyone else. So you're kind of saying, what you talk about, what is the value of Black history? Just take the word Black out of there. What is the value of history?
Well, the value of history is to give people a reference point to understand the present. But beyond that, it's to instruct people as to how we got from there here. And I want to clarify something here. The problem is that history, as written earlier, that was a bad thing to do.
Oh, my gosh. You got to watch this guy.
Yeah. is incomplete unless you give people a comprehensive understanding of events. The historical period, who was involved, what did they do? How can you talk about so-called American history without talking about slavery or the treatment of the Native Americans or the treatment of the Mexicans? How can you really say you're talking about American history without talking about that? Or if you talk about them, you talk about them in the negative. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, I could see viewing history from one point of view would have advantage in being able to act out this role of superiority. But if we truly are seeking to understand human nature, human beings, and human evolution, any important detail you leave out leaves the lesson incomplete.
You're studying the interactions. You're not studying the individuals or what they look like. You're studying the interactions between people and their effect on each other, on
the relationships.
Earth. Relationships.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. You're very true.
Okay. Gee, it's almost noon. It's great. We've got at least 15 more minutes. This is Lee Edwards with special guest John Rivers, and we're on KROV Oroville, 91.1 FM Community Radio. Here's a question, John put it to us here. In what ways has knowledge of Black history influenced the development of Black youths?
Yeah. I think it has influenced the development of Black youth in a powerfully positive way. If Black youth are able to be exposed to history that includes them or their ancestors, it begins to raise the bar for them in the current history, that the images of what it means to be Black in 2013, as reflected by social media and media itself, which is very limiting, does not have the effect that it is currently having, because Black youth can put that in perspective. They can be critical, like you, Lee. They can look at this and say, well, you know, this is projecting an image that has more to do with making money on it than it does in really explaining and giving positive regards to the heritage, the characteristics of these people. black youth says, well, look, you know, I know how my people contributed, wrongly or rightly, to the development of this country. I know that my ancestors were the beginning of the economic growth of this country because they were slaves. I know what slavery is. I knew it was not only prejudicial behavior, but it was also an economic investment, and that the role of that economic investment filled by my ancestors were that they were the workers. They were the ones that went out and harvested the products that were later turned into products that were sold for profit. And the rewards or the benefits for my people during the height of slavery was to not be whooped or hung. That, now, those are bad options.
Yeah, what a reward. We won't beat you. Hold it now. What are you going to do? You ever going to buy me an ice cream cone? What are you going to do good for me?
Right.
Wow, yeah.
But such things as ownership of property or, you know, the pathway to economic success and vitality, that was not...
Yeah, what wasn't in the game, was it?
Yeah.
No. Okay. All right. Do you mind if I just read these down? I mean, this is really good food for thought.
Fine.
Given the research and presentation of black history in schools and colleges, what other areas need to be examined? A lot of these questions you've dealt with in many ways all along, because just like anything else, you can't pick a question. Mm-hmm. You can with math, what's 2 plus 2? Mm-hmm. But when you're dealing with events of history and so on, you're not going to tease out that one little thing. But surely, black history in schools and colleges, what areas... Yeah, what are we missing? Now we've got a Black History Month. We have Black History courses, and you now wouldn't have to go searching so hard if somebody says start a course in our college, because you'd have the material to work on. But what are we missing? What are we missing?
Well, I think more research needs to be done into the concepts and the terms that we've been using and considering what they represent to be normal. For example, the whole issue of race and talking about differences, it's really predicated on skin color. And so what we need to really do more exploration on is how skin color manifests itself throughout the world and how limited or whatever its impact has been on the enhanced understanding of humanity, human beings, in the bigger picture. We get stuck on trying to do payback or to get rid of our sense of guilt or get rid of our feelings of inferiority. So there's a lot of books and a lot of research that'll validate that. But what we haven't really shown is some other things that has happened along the way. For example, and a good example of that is in Oroville. You see, as black people migrated from the South to Oroville, they were patterns of Jim Crow operating here. But what was new for black people is that they had work, that they could have their own community, that they could develop their own social institutions, that the only prohibitions that they experienced was when they tried to socially integrate. Those social boundaries were kept intact. You couldn't date across lines, and you couldn't attend certain activities without some sanction. Those you could live with. And yet, in spite of that, friendships were formed, relationships developed, things, people began to integrate, even during this quasi-Jim Crow atmosphere. Those stories need to be told.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, what about the kids that played together? And
that's right.
That's the cutest thing, if you go to, which I don't much anymore, my kids are all grown, but you go to a public playground or something.
Yeah.
Kids are just one group. They're kids.
That's right.
Color, shape, size, whatever, good clothes, bad clothes, holes in the knees or fancy dresses, whatever. They're just kids.
Right.
They haven't. That's a great thing that I really like, and that is the movie South Pacific. And there's a song in there because it's in the South Pacific, and it's something to do with Europeans and then people from South Pacific who might have a little different color skin and background. Uh-huh. And they talk about kids, and it's something, the title is something like, they have to be carefully taught.
Yeah.
They have to be carefully taught to bias and prejudice. They have to be carefully taught because if you aren't careful, they'll grow up wonderfully normal the way they should be. So that's a really good point there.
Well, it would be a new normal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Normal's a funny word.
Yeah, it would be a new normal. But I raised the question, I think, and now I'm going to get a little bit theoretical, if you don't mind.
No.
There is a point of view that within our society and within the ethos of the American culture are certain shared beliefs. We call them paradigms. Okay? An example of that is race. And the way in which paradigms, cultural paradigms, change is that the old paradigms that we operated with no longer work. They no longer work. And so what we do is we transition from those old paradigms to new paradigms. And it's my view that in spite of ourselves, we're going to be moving into a much more enlightened view of ourselves than, say, our ancestors' experience, because of such things as technology, because of such things as vulnerability, because of such things as the fact that we thought we had conquered nature, but look what's happened. Nature's come back roaring and with all of these catastrophes.
Yeah, sure.
So the old paradigms don't work anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Here's it. You talked about this already, but how has the re-election of the current president impacted race relations in America locally?
I think the best benefit to America for electing Barack Obama, there are two reasons. One is that we haven't gone to such extreme in one direction. I think that benefits everybody, even though there would be my cousins in the Tea Party would not agree with that. But be that as it may, the other reason is that it has brought to us in a very conscious way the issue of race. And if you look at our scientific definitions and classification of race, Barack Obama does not necessarily fit that model, because his mother is a European, his father is an authentic African. Most of the people, in fact, almost all of the people that we visually identify as black are descendants of slaves. And so now we are confronted with this thing because we have been otherwise socialized to experience race as being present. But our definitions don't necessarily work anymore.
Yeah, yeah. All righty, and the last one you have here is, what should be done to improve race relations in America? Hey, take a while to answer that one, maybe. Mm. Maybe not. Maybe you have some constructs that are very specific.
Well, I think what we have to do is learn from the South Africans.
Yeah.
And it's nothing new. The truth will set you free. Don't be afraid of the truth. Don't buy any of the causation for whatever has happened in the past as your fault. But recognize that if you know something and there's a need to use that knowledge to make things better, go ahead and do it. So I think that the more we talk about race and recognize race and examine race, we'll see its illusionary power. And we'll say, that won't work anymore. What works now is people sharing and cooperating to solve real problems. Race is a problem if we constrained ourselves in how we address problems. But it's not a problem if we understand what it is and what it isn't.
Yeah.
So I think that more education, real education, around the truth will give us much better options than we're faced with now, because it's the either-or thing. And nothing happens when you live a life of either-or.
Yeah, like, how about envisioning the day, this is really fanciful, when the term race, Daddy, what's race? You know, like, what was that? Yeah. What was that like? I guess that's fanciful, but all the same, that's a nice vision to behold.
Well, I've learned something about you, Lee. Again, you are critical, but you're very hopeful.
Well, I hope I've preempted that. I've tried to silence. I spent the better part of my life up till about the age 40 in total concentration on surviving, raising a family, and the word political and all these other social things. They didn't work. They weren't a part of my life. And then somebody turned on a big light. So ever since then, I've been delving into things that I wonder how I missed them. Sometimes I wish I hadn't, because it's easier to have a very simplistic view of life. But you got to be.
Yeah.
You got to have John Rivers telling you what's cooking, and he's got to have people to inform, and people to inform him. It's like it's not an easy thing. Okay, I'm keep looking at this watch. You know, we don't have to worry about the watch, but technically we're getting close to the end. I just want to see if I had, because I did listen to one of our prior talks that I had, if there was something I was missing out of here. I just love that quote of yours. People who have come out of bondage, established themselves as an integral part of this country, and still have a long way to go towards equity. It's easy to say how silly, because I haven't been black and oppressed, or none of my family has. But it gets in the way of life, doesn't it? It just gets in the way of living. It's not about anything like what color person is. We got things to do, you know. We got problems to deal with.
Well, that's a vast issue, human issue. It's beyond race.
Yeah.
It's the quality of a person's life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I often go back to, in some of my classes I teach now, because there's a very important part of the American story that I don't believe we project and develop images that help us to understand its importance. If you look at the first part of the American Constitution, there's the word happiness.
Yeah.
The pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
Now, of course, Jefferson was talking about the landowners, the people who were writing the Constitution.
Sure.
And more or less defining themselves in relationship to the Europeans, to the English. But the pursuit of happiness is a goal of the state. That's a pretty powerful statement. You will not find that term in any constitution or organizing document of any society on the planet. That's what's unique about Americans. Now, we can argue about the qualification, happiness for white men, landowners only. If we only take those kinds of narrow views, we don't get the essence of the thinking, of the enlightenment that was represented in those words. And so I do think that that the social psychologists and people who work with international affairs have a very good term that they use in bringing diverse views and countries together towards a common good. And they call it the superordinate goal. There is a goal that is higher and more important than the individual or the cluster of goals that are represented around the table. There's something we all need, cherish, and desire. And that's what we got to identify. I believe that, for me, the superordinate goal in my life, and I would invite this for everybody, is happiness. It's not easy to recognize, or once you recognize it and you start to experience it, to maintain it, but keep it there as a purpose for your life and for your living. And you'll get beyond all of these Neanderthal limits like race and gender and all of that. You can be a total human being. And nobody on this planet can tell you you're wrong.
I want to leave that. I'm going to leave that with people. And folks, if you didn't get it all, I promise I have this recorded. I'm going to go here and cut down the recording for this show right now, and we'll get on to something else. But you remember those words, folks.